is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein. As you listen to this, it is Wednesday, August the 4th. So welcome to the, we're definitely in the back half of summer at this point. But before I get started with today's interview, I want to make sure that I give a shout out to all of the patrons of the show. And if you're interested in making a monthly contribution to the podcast to help keep it on the air and available and all of those kind of things, go to patreon.com/ the Mind and Fitness Podcast. So I'll start from the furthest back because Kim has been donating to this podcast now for almost 3 years, as has Barb, as has Arnie. So thank you to the three of you. But then also Brian and Julie, Ross, Christina, Jen and Nate, Anthony, Victoria, Michael, Francisco, Tony, Kelly, Irina, Mindy, Matthew, Colette, Jason, Carey, Brooke, John, Valerie, and James. Thank you all so much from the bottom of my heart for continuing to contribute to the podcast. Now, on the line with me, is it weird? Christy Weeby's on the line. And is it weird that every time that I talk to you, I sort of feel like I'm talking to like a low key celebrity? Is anything weird about that?
That's one of my favorite things I've heard in a while. So I'm thrilled to hear it. I don't know how you ended up there, but I'm glad to hear it.
It was something I was thinking about. I think it's because of like what I think that there's something to watching somebody that has been on anything video that has like post-production, and from watching all the Feelings and Stuff episodes, and I'm like, oh, this person's legit.
Oh, right? Yeah. I love that. Well, I feel every time I speak with you, I'm talking to an old friend, so I hope that feels good as well.
It's very flattering. Thank you. Okay. If you've been listening to this podcast a long time, Christy joined me about 3 years ago, and then she was also the person that joined the podcast the day after COVID-19 was declared a global pandemic. And I had asked her, hey, before you jump on, can you please go back? And I never ask guests to do this because it's just another point out of your time. But I had said, hey, go back and listen to the podcast to hear the things we were talking about so we can reference back to them. But before we get into that stuff, you're like Carmen Sandiego. Where on earth are you at this point in time?
Oh my gosh. At this moment, I'm in Connecticut, where okay. Technically I live. You will not find me here a lot of the time, but I'm in Connecticut. We're riding this out through the end of the year, and then we'll see where the work takes us.
I've been in Connecticut as a six-year-old, but I am a very big pro wrestling nerd, and Connecticut is the hub of the WWE. So where in Connecticut are you?
Okay, well, I grew up here and didn't know that. Even at all.
Oh,
so
come
that's
on.
Where okay. I'm at with the WWE, but I live in Simsbury. It's a little suburb, maybe 20, 25 minutes north of Hartford.
Okay. So the WWE headquarters is located in Stamford. And it has okay. been, it has been since the early 80s. So that's funny that like, you know, they're a big global entity, right? It's not like they're nothing. And I know that for a long time, people can say, haha, pro wrestling, whatever, but they are a global brand. I'm surprised Connecticut's not huge, so I'm surprised that
no. I am also surprised. I'm a little embarrassed.
Well, put that into your your Connecticut book of knowledge or whatever we want to call it.
So thank you.
What are you working on? You had said go where the work takes us. So talk a little bit about what it is that you're doing at this juncture, this point in time. Because I know there's been different projects over the last couple of years that have taken you from LA to Vegas to Connecticut to Connecticut to Vegas again. Like I think there was a little bit of bouncing back and forth. So talk about that.
Absolutely. I'm so impressed that you can keep track. I barely can. I was in Vegas the last time we talked at the start of the pandemic. So yeah, around my March 2020, I was in Vegas working on a pilot program there where United Health Group was working to test the feasibility and the effectiveness of offering mind-body treatment within a traditional pain management system. So I was out in Vegas getting that set up. I'm still working with United Health Group and crossing my fingers that we get to practice or execute another round of the pilot program in Arizona. I have told them I'm drawing a line in the sand. I'm not moving to Arizona. I will continue supporting them from afar. So that's where we're at with research. I'm doing that with Howard Kubiner and a wonderful team, trying to see what it's like when we test mind-body treatment within the traditional medical system. And then I'm in my own private practice. I'm working with patients with mind-body disorder. And I'm starting a group practice actually next month. So that's the thing I'm most excited about right now.
Awesome. Okay. And so you're back to, because at the time when we last had done, and I'll do a lot of bouncing back and forth, and it gets, if it gets obnoxious, just say so. But the back when we had the last conversation, you know, people were doing telehealth. Is that still, like, when you talk about group, you know, about doing group sessions, is that going to be like via telehealth, or are you back doing in person in private practice, or what's kind of the breakdown as the world sits right now?
So a lot of therapists are still primarily working virtually, not necessarily exclusively due to safety concerns, but because people got used to it and it expanded our access to so many clients that it served a benefit to both practitioner and patient alike. So I'm fully remote right now. I'm hoping to be able to get back into real life therapy at some point in the near future, just because I miss it. But telehealth is great. People have adjusted.
How that, because that was going to be a question I was going to say at some point in this, but since we're there, can you just talk about the, I guess, like from a therapist perspective, and if you can speak to this at all, if you've gotten any good feedback from patients or clients that you've worked with, because one thing that I was concerned about, and I would get emails from people that had the same concern, is like treating mind body but not in person and doing it online. I mean, how did it seem like results were more mixed than they would be in person, or did it take longer to maybe start making dents in, when I say dents in people, you know what I mean, but just talk about like treating mind body over the internet as opposed to treating mind body in person.
I have found shockingly little difference between treating someone in person versus treating someone remotely. And studies have actually shown that telehealth is just as effective form of treatment. For me, the big contingency is that there's a video component. I do not like treating people over the phone. I think it's very easy to check out, to distract yourself. I don't think you can be fully plugged in. The only caveat I would say when I'm working with someone over video is they might be a little more nervous the first session or two, because there's some level of, you know, formality. You can't feel the energy, the comfort of the person in the room, but truly that passes within a session or two. And in terms of making progress on the symptoms, I see no difference when we're comparing in person to telehealth with a video component.
How, when somebody comes to you and they say, they submit a form on your website or however the way that somebody would typically get in touch with you, are they being referred by a doctor oftentimes, or have they heard your name elsewhere, or what's usually like the vehicle to which they find you?
Ooh, that's a fun question, because it relates back to this projects that we're launching with the United Health Group. If someone finds me personally, they've sought me out. They've read all the books, two or three times. They've done the TMS Wiki programs. They've listened to the podcast. They're seeking me out because they know they have a mind-body disorder and they want to work with me. But what's interesting, just as a point of comparison, when I was working with United Health Group and seeing patients there, it was one of the first experiences where we were offering mind-body treatment hot off the presses, so to speak. So it was coming directly, the referral was coming directly from a quote-unquote traditional pain management physician. So we had the opportunity to have this a blank slate in terms of the patient's understanding, which obviously has some pros and some cons in it. So I've gotten to experience both ends of the spectrum, and there's things that work and things that really don't work about both referral streams.
So there are, and I know you had said, you'd sent me a text yesterday to say, like, here's some of the areas to focus on. Some of these have crossover, but there's just, because I listened to the interview this morning, I went out and took my lab Lucy for a walk, and every time I would hear something in her way, most of the time, sometimes. she's in a very sweet mode right now because she went to doggy daycare on Saturday, and she's still just so pooped. Like, just, it was just too much. It was too much. So she's in a very sweet state of mind right now, but give it a day and then she'll be wild again. So some of the things that had jumped out at me now, where I want to start, I want to go back to, cause I went back and I looked at what was the data involving the United States deaths, that kind of thing. And because a big theme of what we talked about was really like being able to, you would say, differentiating productive versus unproductive news and noise and that kind of thing. So I went back and I looked at the data, like where was the, because the world did feel like it was collapsing at that point in time. To put it into perspective, the day that we recorded that, the U.S. set their new daily death record for COVID at 12 people, which is crazy because a couple months later we hit 6,000 in a day. And then by winter, the rolling 7-day average was 3,000 and it stayed there for 2 months. So radically different. And at the time, I think it was like 75% of the world's reported deaths came from my state, about 10 miles away in a town called Kirkland. And then obviously it expanded. It went way out. Even though Washington was leading for the first month or so in cases, we're now, I don't know, 35th or something like that. So we're pretty far down. So there's been a lot of change. So maybe as I say these quotes, if you have any sort of, I don't know, additional wisdom you can offer as it relates to these. Are you cool with that? I put a lot of these things that you said in quotations. Okay. So, one of them that you had said was, anxiety increases as uncertainty increases. We really didn't know anything at that juncture. And then as the months went on, it felt like we knew more. And now I'm sort of back in a position where the waters feel sort of muddy again, but talk about, I guess the uncertainty then versus any uncertainty that may happen now and that kind of thing as a therapist.
Absolutely. Okay. So let's start by going back to then. So we last talked March of 2020. Obviously the mind-body community is not a monolith, but by and large, the dominant trend at that time is that mind-body symptoms were increasing at the start of the pandemic due to the uncertainty and all of the other stressors that all of us encountered. So people with existing symptoms experienced an increase or potentially a relapse as they were grappling with those new threats and that uncertainty. And then a lot of people who never considered themselves to be chronic pain sufferers became aware of pain, anxiety, or depression for the first time. In some ways, for those people, it's like mind-body symptoms were put on the map last year just due to the overwhelm of threat and stress. And the mental health field at large just experienced such a surge and a demand for services. And in many places, that was far outweighed by the supply of available practitioners. So all of that is to say, the uncertainty and the threat that entered our lives last year, and it wasn't just COVID-19 that was threatening us. There was a whole host of other stressors, social isolation, financial insecurity, family and relationship strain, education interruptions, there was socioeconomic and racial health disparities. I mean, the list was incredible and overwhelming. So the pretty clear cut and dominant trend when we spoke last time in the thick of the pandemic was mind-body symptoms were on the rise. Now we're in this weird quasi post-pandemic phase. And I say quasi for a couple of reasons. The first being that we're experiencing this new wave of uncertainty with the Delta variant and what that might mean. And the second reason I say quasi post-pandemic is just the major qualifier that the access the United States and other high-income countries have to vaccines and treatments. It just puts us in a day-to-day life that feels rather post-pandemic, which certainly isn't true for many other countries around the world. So I mentioned that just to recognize that it's not as simple as saying pre and post pandemic. So maybe I'll just simplify by comparing now versus then. What we're seeing now, as I'm talking to you in July of 2021, it feels like there's more of a diversity of experience going on. That's what I'm seeing with my clients and also what I'm seeing, honestly, in my personal life. Whereas then, in March of 2020, there was a universal rise in anxiety. What I'm seeing now includes more diversity of experience. Some people, and maybe most people, are definitely experiencing some level of symptom relief, right? Like there's a returning to baseline that's happening for a lot of us. Our nervous systems are calming down. The world is starting to look a little bit more normal. I think a lot of people can relate to this. Like schools are reopening, masks are coming off, people are hugging again. I shook someone's hand the other day.
How'd that feel?
I don't I didn't know if I was doing something kind or offensive. It was so confusing to me. But I did it. Seemed to be okay. So that's trend number one, and perhaps the most obvious one that I'm seeing now, that some people and many people might be feeling better than they were before. But there's another trend that I'm seeing, and it feels a bit more complicated. And I think this is what you were alluding to when you were saying that the uncertainty that we're experiencing now is morphing and changing in front of our eyes, because there are still many people who are really struggling at this juncture to feel that nervous system come down. And I think a lot of that lingering anxiety has to do with this inability to achieve blanket safety as it relates to COVID-19. Like, the threat of harm to ourselves and our loved ones seems to have most certainly decreased, but it has not been altogether eliminated. And a lot of people in the mind-body community really struggle with that kind of ambiguity. We're watching some people take their masks off, but some people haven't. Some people have resumed travel, but some people haven't. Some people have gone back to in-person places of work, but some people haven't, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it can be hard for individuals who are already struggling with anxiety and mind-body disorders to trust themselves in establishing their own safety measures, because generally speaking, it just feels better to have a clear roadmap. And put simply, I think we're still very far away from having any kind of clear roadmap out of this mess. So that's the second trend that I'm seeing, is this state of lingering vigilance, like a start and a stop, a want to have blanket safety, but an inability to achieve it.
Right. So you stole some of the thunder, because one of the things you just said was one of the five quotes or five things that I wrote down that I wanted to bring up. You had a quote that you said,
"Oh, great!
This is one of the only moments in history where everyone is feeling the same way." And you said that sort of has evolved into a little bit more of a diverse experience. But the note that I put after that, the sub note that I put right after that was, but seemingly, maybe it's not half, maybe it's like 30% or 40% or whatever the case is. And I'm speaking just about the United States, because that's all I can really speak about. That seemingly half or so of the country kind of thinks this whole thing is a hoax still, and has for a long time. So I don't know how far down that rabbit hole you want to get, but that was the first thought that came in my mind, because it did, in those first few days, did remind me a lot of 9/11. In a way where,
we're
having a shared experience, and unfortunately, like, you would think that it's an international tragedy, but it certainly is a national tragedy, because at this point in time, about 615 or so thousand people have died who died unnecessarily. And basically, what you're saying is essentially 9/11 every day for a year and a half. And if you were to just jump to somebody and say, hey, 9/11 was a hoax, which some people do, it wouldn't be received all that well. We're talking about 9/11 happening about 350 times at this point in time. So how long do you think it took after the initial few days of all this stuff to really kind of ramp up, but before you sort of felt like, maybe we're not all feeling the same way? Like, I know you had said that now there's a difference, but when did that start to shift in your mind?
I think, at least from my corner of the world and my vantage point, I definitely started seeing this by at least last summer, so a full year ago, when that initial round of more intensive lockdowns was starting to lighten up and summer was coming. I think people's tolerance for the isolation and the stress, I think we started to hit our breaking point then, a full year ago. I think some people did a better job of reminding themselves that this is a marathon, not a sprint. But that's where I started seeing things diversifying, and where I started seeing people not being able to view the same situation through the same lens. And that's where all the different realities started coming into play. And wherever you fall on that spectrum, whatever your reality is, if you're a person who struggles with anxiety, that's confusing. That's disorienting. And it is very difficult to be able to put one foot in front of the other and trust yourself when you don't even know what reality to align to.
Yeah. It makes me think of, and it's not even a good transition, but I personally, because I haven't seen a therapist regularly since it was like mid-2018, my guy retired, might have even been a little bit into that summer. And I have felt, okay, I'm good. It would be nice to have somebody to talk to, but it's not something that I don't have. The thing that happens to me where I'm like, okay, I need to do some journaling, or I need to do something a little bit more involved than just having an awareness, came when I was glued to the TV on January 6th, and I couldn't look away. So I had reached out to there's a psychological services office here that has a bunch of different therapists, and so I read all their bios. Who do I feel like I would align with most? And made a couple of appointments with him. The trouble was that, and this is a whole separate issue, but just my insurance, which I'm told is really good, or was really good. I got off it because it wasn't really good. I had my first appointment, and it was like, I think I got billed like $300, and they said my deductible was $10,000 before anything would be covered. And I was just thinking it was over telehealth, and he did seem a little bit disengaged. But I just, you know, again, it was just on my mind all the time, because I'm sitting here in my house in the suburbs, and there's thousands of people that are all over the news, and they're in different parts of the U.S. Mm-hmm. Capitol. And it felt so surreal that it literally felt like a movie. It felt like I was watching Independence Day, or, you know, one of these kind of action flicks with things that you just can't really reconcile. And so that was a big hurdle and challenge for me, just being able to quiet down that noise. And it got to a point to where on my work computer, I got a site blocker, and I blocked CNN and Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and pretty much anything that I was spending way too much time. Just nothing was changing. And the last time that something like that happened in my life, where I was so deeply vested in latching on to one particular thing, was the Malaysian Airlines flight that was lost in 2014. And that was kind of the same thing. I couldn't keep my eyes off of it. So I don't really know how or what you, or if there's any commentary when it comes to that particular point in time, but that for me was sort of that was the boiling over of the tea kettle, was that watching all that stuff and seeing this alternate reality manifest itself on TV.
Oh, big time. I want to respond to everything you just said, but I can't let it go unspoken. I'm sorry that you ended up meeting with a disengaged therapist, someone that you didn't necessarily fully connect with. That you've been through it enough to know that therapy can work, but you really need to have that goodness of fit. So that's upsetting to hear. And there was some weirdness in 2020 in the mental health field, because we as therapists were experiencing the same threat as our clients. So it was, we didn't have space around the issue as we were helping people through it. And I wonder, and that's a whole different conversation, but I wonder if that might have been impacting your treatment, that the providers didn't have a chance to take a break from the threat. We were inundated with it session after session. So not fair to you as the client, and I'm glad you tried to seek help. Just wanted to say that's upsetting to hear anytime someone goes looking for support and it doesn't feel good.
Yeah. Yeah. What about any other commentary on the other stuff, the observing of the alternate reality? Yeah. Because there was a lot of people sitting at home I talked to at least a handful of people that they were very shook by that, regardless of the side that they were on. They were shook in some way. Either they were compelled to go watch the Mel Gibson movie, The Patriot, and it made them feel so proud. Or you have the flip side, people like me or people that I'm closer with that are just like, God, is this the end? Like, is this how the country goes down, and how it burns, and how there's a civil war? And now, like, I'm not talking to neighbors and all that kind of stuff. Like, that's kind of how it all went. Talk about that. You know, and I know you said that there's some election stuff, and so maybe this is a good time to talk about that.
Oh, yeah, let's do it. I have a lot of thoughts on this. So, in speaking and thinking about the lead up to the election itself, and the weeks thereafter, now is a good time to bring back this concept of uncertainty. So, the thing about uncertainty is that we just aren't humans, are not designed for it. when we think about our nervous systems and the role of fight or flight, there's an inherent human want to quickly assess the people and the environment around us as either safe or dangerous. There's not a comfortable in between. So if something is a little bit dangerous or potentially dangerous, we will remain vigilant by default. So when we're cast into a state of uncertainty, our nervous system feels like it can't rest until the threat has been assessed. Are we safe or are we in harm? The election was obviously a breeding ground for uncertainty. And to make matters worse, like you were saying, there are all kinds of hour by hour and sometimes minute by minute trackers of votes coming in and dozens of different projections and possibilities being updated in real time. And you know, people in the chronic pain community, we have a love-hate relationship with tracking things. We hate how much we love tracking the little ups and downs of our symptoms. And we probably had a similar dynamic going on with the ups and downs of the vote. So we felt unsafe. We weren't able to gauge if the situation was going to ultimately end up feeling good or bad to us. And we had all of these trackers in our face that made us feel addicted to, if I can track this and understand this outcome, am I going to be able to put this threat assessment game to rest? And then that lasted weeks. And I'd like to mention that I think it's important that this period was particularly difficult for a lot of people because it did not feel comfortable or true to say, you know what, it'll be okay either way. With either outcome of this election, no matter which way the country goes, everything is going to be all right. That's a really common strategy in anxiety reduction, is to be able to say, I'm going to be able to make it through regardless. If it goes this way or if it goes that way, I'm going to be okay. I don't think people had access to that, a lot of people. I personally felt emotionally extremely unsafe, and I could not find a way to lower the stakes of the situation. And I say that as a white woman with job security, among other privileges, that were tremendously benefiting me during the thick of that uncertainty last year. There were millions of other people and minority groups who were grappling with genuine financial, legal, and physical threats that felt like they hinged on the outcome of the election and of that time period, fall to winter, going from 20 to 21. So I think that's what made the election and the time period around it so tough. It's not only that it was prolonged uncertainty, but the stakes of the situation felt non-negotiably high.
Again, a hard turn, but maybe this will end up, because a lot of the stuff that, at least a little while ago, in observing the new, because one of the things that you had said about differentiating productive versus non-productive is you had said, you know, basically pick something that you rely on or that you can trust or that you feel like you can trust to sort of follow the sequence of events. And this was relating to the pandemic. So if it's the CDC or the WHO, or if it's a particular news outlet, or whatever the case is, but it would seem to me that regardless of what kind of news outlet it is that you follow, none of them really did a great job with a lot of this stuff. And I feel like almost all sources became untrustworthy in the last year and contributed to people's problems. What's your take on that?
Oh, 100%, especially because we're so polarized to begin with. I think the news outlets are going to have a hell of a time trying to add nuance into any situation when the want in society is to polarize as fast as you can.
Yeah.
And I think we've all just kind of hit our stimulation limit, I think, with not only with the news, but this is kind of a side note, but I'm finding that as people are re-engaging with society now that some of the restrictions of the pandemic have loosened, it's just like we don't have the tolerance that we had before for stimulation, period. Whether it's the news or whether it's just engaging with humans on a day-to-day basis, I think our thresholds have changed and we're just less patient and more easily exhausted than we were at the start of all of this.
I think that's a really perfect way to put it. I mean, I know, like, at least in my professional life, and I work in software, that my manager had been saying throughout the year, because our fiscal runs July 1st to June 30th, and he had said, you know, this is going to be the toughest year of your career. I actually did great, but I felt like I had to work extra hard to be really, really good. But being on Zoom every day and not going into people's offices or seeing my clients in person or doing that whole thing. And then it's hard to even imagine that the first 3 months of the pandemic was also like, you know, homeschooling with kids and having both kids home and then doing customer calls and all this kind of stuff, that the overall stress loads of people in general really just like such an absolute fever pitch. I mean, I can't, and I know there's a lot of people that had it a lot tougher, people that have been homeschooling for a year and a half, and you know, hopefully their kid will go back in the fall, but who really knows? There was something that we talked about in that last episode too, where you had said, we got on the toilet paper hoarding discussion, and you had basically said, like, this is a, you know, it's a way to maintain control. What were some equivalents that maybe as the hoarding let down and you could go to your local Costco and find some, what were some equivalents over time that, you know, because I always say when people will email me and they'll be like, I have knee pain and all that, you know, Sarno's book is called Healing Back Pain, so it's not about me. And I'll always say, okay, well, like, one person's back pain is your knee pain. So one person's toilet hoarding is another person's fill in the blank. Are there any other additional trends that you would see pop up a lot over, you know, once the toilet paper thing was over, what were some other things that people were doing as coping, basically?
I saw a lot of this vigilance and tracking as it related to vaccinations. At the start, it was discussion around just the safety and efficacy of the vaccinations and tracking that. And then that kind of blew up to which vaccination might be best. And then there was a lot of tracking around scheduling of the vaccinations and how to get in as early as possible if you were choosing to get vaccinated. And then there was a whole other through line for people, again, especially in the mind body community, around fear of the vaccination itself, and not necessarily in like that in the traditional and or buzzy way that we're seeing in the news. I had clients who really wanted the vaccination, just they have fear of anything health related. So they were trapped in this place of, I have all this anxiety, or I'm getting the vaccination scheduled and I'm tracking this, that, and that, and I have all these tabs open around getting in as soon as I can. And at the same time, I'm totally terrified to do it. And I feel like all of these symptoms could pop up. And I had people actually have little chronic pain relapses after the vaccination, not as a result of the vaccination, but a conditioned response of fear doing anything to their body that was new or different. So I saw all kinds of buzz and vigilance and tracking when the vaccination rollout began.
So it's really, I mean, as human beings, we're essentially just playing a game of, what can I obsess over next? What can I stress out about?
The whack-a-mole. Yes.
This is something that's been going on in my personal life for the last little while. And this is way dumber than like vaccine efficacy or anything like that, but it's important to me. So I'm an avid motorcycle rider, right? And I've had this motorcycle that I go on these long tours with, and I took the 101 from Seattle all the way down to the Redwoods and did all that kind of stuff. And, with this one bike that I had about 3 years ago, I saw a prototype of a new bike, that was less powerful than mine, but more agile, less weight, more fun, more built for somebody my size, which I'm 5'7", 175 pounds. I'm not a big guy. And then supply chain issues across the world made this particular motorcycle the hardest one to find on planet Earth. So I put deposits down at multiple places, and then I got the call about a month ago that your bike is here. Do you want it, or are you passing? And I got it, and I'm looking at them both right now, and I must get rid of one of them. My wife says, if it's so stressful, just keep them both. It's not a big deal. But I'm like, I got to make a decision. So I find myself at night, you know, what are the things that I'm losing if I sell this, you know, my old motorcycle? What compromises am I making? So it's always like the second guessing of yourself, which is related to, you know, get this vaccine, but I'm looking at the efficacy rates and maybe I'm a little bit scared. I guess, like, what would you say to a neurotic motorcycle fan like me that has these two beautiful machines, wants to keep one. One of them's so fun, but it's, you know, maybe it's not as powerful as my last one, so I'm missing out on that. You know, literally, I just do, Christy, I do this shit all day in my head. This is just what happens.
I know. I know. So do I. I've been there. Yeah. It's just a beautiful, contained place to put your anxiety and your wondering. I remember when I relate so much to the motorcycle debacle. When I first had my daughter, she was probably a couple weeks old, and I wanted to buy her different socks. I'm certain that she had enough socks, but she needed more. And I literally spent 4 hours comparing all the different types. I could send you an Excel document on the different types of socks, the sizes, the way that they're, this one is size 0 to 3 months, this one's 0 to 6, but this one lasts for this long, this, that, and the other, all to what? Save $3, yeah. And get for some socks that would last. It was so, and I could see it while I was doing it. Wow, I'm a new mom. That's overwhelming. So many things are out of my control. What can I control? This bizarre, neurotic spreadsheet about baby socks.
Yeah.
And I just gave myself permission to do it. It is a container for all the anxiety that we are feeling outside of whatever we are obsessing about. And if it's every so often about motorcycles or socks, fine, give it to yourself. Obviously, if that's something you're struggling with on a day-to-day basis, it can become pretty overwhelming and dysfunctional. So there's a spectrum to it. But I really understand what you're saying. I've been there.
Every time that I tell myself, this is so dumb, it's just a motorcycle. And then I think to myself, yeah, but I had all the fun on this other one. But then I also say to myself, I've literally, in 12 years of riding, I've never had a bad time on any motorcycle. It doesn't matter if it's a teeny tiny little one that can't even go 40 miles an hour, or it's a massive one that a guy that's a big Harley rider that's 6'10" and 350 pounds would typically ride. Like, I've never had a bad time on a motorcycle, which is why all this is so stupid. But, you know, people have said sometimes it sucks and sometimes right. It's motorcycles, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right. Whatever we need, Eddie.
Yeah.
Ourselves a little gray.
You know, there's a really good, have you ever heard of the documentary? I'm nearly sure that it's called The United States of Stress. Have you ever heard of that documentary?
No.
So, so it's on HBO. It's on HBO Max. And it's actually done by, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, who is the chief medical officer for CNN now. But it's it's talking about the overwhelming. And this was done way pre-pandemic. I think this was probably a 2018 or 2017 documentary. But he goes over the crippling health issues that happened simply as a result of an overabundance of stress and stressful situations and the things we put ourselves under. He's focusing a lot more on, you know, he's not talking about backaches and things like that. He's talking about heart disease and he's talking about diabetes and he's talking about a lot of these more biological in nature, that at least what I would call them. But a lot of that is kind of the stuff that I think about. And I'd be curious for him to do like a follow up now after 2020 and the way that it's been. But it sounds like a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about.
Ooh. Absolutely. And Sarno makes mention of this, I mean, in his book as well. There's how I classify in my head, from the spectrum of TMS, there's true TMS or straight TMS, straight up, where pain is in your body and there's absolutely no tie to anything going on pathologically or structurally. And then there's like blended TMS, right? Where stress is causing some sort of biological or pathological change. And I think the sooner we can get the medical community. When was that documentary made, by the way? Do you have any idea?
I'm pretty sure it's 2017, but let me
States. Okay, of, so it's pretty recent.
I'm at my computer. United States of Stress documentary. It was released in 2019, so I feel like it probably was filmed in 2018, probably.
Okay.
And it's called It's called One Nation Under Stress.
One Nation Under Stress. I want to check that out. we need more of that. The more that we're able to push into mainstream medicine that stress can cause symptoms that are real and cause some suffering in the absence of structural or pathological damage, and stress can trigger actual biological change in our bodies that gives us viruses and has an impact on the development of serious diseases, I mean, the better off we are for a million reasons. Patient education, prevention, and also accurate and appropriate treatment, and fingers crossed, insurance coverage for that treatment, which is a big part of what we're doing at the United Project, is trying to help people understand this is the treatment for pain. You need to include psychotherapy. You need to include stress topics on emotional health and stress management. And this needs to be a covered benefit. So the more that that's pushed mainstream, the better off we're going to be in getting people this treatment.
You know, that was one thing that, so Adam Heller, who wrote the book, Zero Pain Now, which it's a Sarno derivative. And he's not a medical doctor, a psychotherapist, or anything that falls in that realm. He's a guy like me that, you know, had a bunch of back issues and put out some content and people started getting better because of it. And some people think that he's got some like slime ball sales guy tactics, but or tendencies or the things that he says or whatever. But I think his book is fabulous. And that was one project that he started. I don't know where it's at now, but that was some project he was working on 3 or 4 years ago, was trying to work with insurance companies as opposed to like individual people, because he sort of felt like it's great to tackle this on a person by person and case by case basis. But if it's a systemic problem where companies don't do things to help with it, some have EAP programs or whatever, and then insurance companies don't cover it or have a tough time covering it or have some kind of a wonky coverage like with mine, where I pay this exorbitant amount every single month for insurance, and yet I need to spend another $10,000 a year, whatever the case is, just to be able to see a therapist. That doesn't really make much sense. And so, like, let's say that this project that you're working on, everything goes exactly the way that you want it to go. Like, what is different in 2 or 3 years down the road?
Physicians are recognizing that this is a contributor or cause of debilitating pain and illness, which means that they are pushing psychotherapeutic treatments as a frontline defense. If we can, and I don't want to put all the onus on physicians, but the more that the medical community is educated and accepts this stress as a valid, again, contributor or cause to pain and illness, the closer we're going to be to having insurance coverage for it. There's so much of the mental health stigma baked in to the medical system, and I believe that's a huge reason why there's not insurance coverage for it. People think of mind-body treatment as alternative, optional, luxurious even. Like that stuff we don't have to cover, because we don't believe at the core there's any contributing factor or causal factor related to stress. So we don't have to treat that. You can do that on your own time and your own money. Come back to us when you want to treat your body.
Right.
So for me, if all goes as planned, we're referring patients into mind-body treatment as frontline defense, and it's covered the same way that we get coverage for injections and medications.
Now, I always think, and maybe I'm wrong because I don't work on that side. Whenever I think of anything at an insurance level or anything that's, you know, that's a big undertaking. If you've ever tried to call Comcast or any of these major companies to ask anything, it seems like there's so much red tape to go through. The project that you're working on, like, is it something where there could be real change that quickly, like in the next couple of years?
That's the hope. And New Age T and the networks that they work with, I mean, they work fast. When they want something done, they can get it done. So there is a lot of buzz and excitement around this idea. And you've got to test it out. You've got to put it to work in a traditional pain management system and see how it goes. And that's what we did in Vegas. And it created enough buzz and excitement that we're doing it again with different networks, a different iteration in Arizona. So momentum is building. For sure. I believe that this is something we can see real change on. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I think about is the bill that I saw, is I had shoulder surgery 5 years ago, and knowing what I know now, there was a kind of a sequence of events that I think really could have lent itself to where, like, yeah, I did have this pathological stuff that you could see on imaging. However, just before surgery, several months had passed, my stress had dramatically diminished, and my pain was at 1%, right? It was unbearable for months, and I was on painkillers and all that kind of stuff for several months. But then I, in the weeks leading up to the surgery, I remember this statement that a doctor told me, and I went into her office on painkillers. She said to me, you know, these are your MRI results, and it's not great, but it's not something that has to be operated on immediately, and you can go back to your sport and just kind of do, you know, the things that you want, and if it hurts, then back off a little bit. That day, I got off the prescription medication that I was on, and my pain level dropped dramatically, which would tell me that that there's definitely correlation there, and that could have been it rearing its ugly head. When I got the bill for the surgery before the insurance had covered it, I mean, it was 50 physical therapy sessions over the course of 5 months, and then also a reconstructive surgery of my labrum, my rotator cuff, and a fracture that I had at the top of my arm. And the total bill between all of them that insurance was billed was like, you know, $266,000 or something stupid. Ooh. Like that. Is part of the case that you're trying to make maybe to large entities, is it, hey, if somebody comes in and we can work with them, you know, and they have a session a week or whatever the breakdown would be, and it's, you know, $100 or a couple $100 or a few $100 or whatever the case is, that is a dramatic less investment than spending $200,000 on somebody's surgery. Like, is that a part of the equation? Because in my world, in software, it's all, what's the return, right? If I'm going to invest all this money into product development, what are we actually going to get back for our customers? Is there any of that that's going on with how with the proposals and the pitches and the projects that you're doing?
Absolutely. 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 That's what the big systems in some ways need to hear and want to hear in order to make any of this work. I think there's a misconception that, oh, psychotherapy, that's so slow. That'll take forever. You need to start from what happened when you were 5 all the way to what brought you into the office today. The reason any of this stuff started with United anyway, United Health Group, was the Boulder back pain study in 2018 that where we tested pain reprocessing therapy for the first time. That was 8 sessions done over the course of 4 weeks. And the results in terms of back pain reduction were remarkable. So that's what United Health Group is going off of, is saying, hey, sure, we need 8 to 12 sessions to make progress with these patients. Give us 2 or 3 months. Your alternative is this crazy expensive surgery that will more than likely do nothing in terms of pain reduction, but potentially lead to future other surgeries, injections, and failed treatments. So a part of what we're doing is helping them renegotiate the way that they're conceptualizing time. We need 2 to 3 months on the front end, but that's not slow. Psychotherapy does not need to be slow when it comes to pain reduction.
And if there's anybody listening to this right now, by the way, that is on the fence about any of this stuff or thinks, Christy might be a little nuts, here's one thing I will anecdotally tell you, is that I had that shoulder reconstruction, and I whack-a-moled away the shoulder, got medical clearance, and then got sciatica, and then had neck and back issues, and then had a neck procedure, and then probably spent about $15,000 out of pocket on various types of uncovered meaning insurance, types of therapies and treatments and things like that. And I laid in a hammock and I read Dr. Sarno's book, and within about 6 hours, 8 hours, whatever, of finishing his book, I would say I felt probably 40% or so better, and enough to go from months of doing nothing but walking around the track down in my little neighborhood to lifting a barbell again. And to me,
wow,
you know, that's nothing to smammer at, right? Like, that's the proof in the pudding is that. And just to think of getting back, because it was Monday I'd see a doctor, Tuesday I'd see a physical therapist, Wednesday I'd see a chiropractor, Thursday I'd go and see a Rolfer or something that was an alternative therapy. And that went on for almost a year. And so absolutely, the perception of things being slow and working on things and stuff like that, okay, 8 to 12 sessions or 8 to 12 weeks or whatever the split is on that may seem like a long time. But if there's one thing that I think that the gift of mind-body stuff has given me is that, like, I got time. Like, that's one thing I just keep going back to and thinking about is that, look, you spent so long doing it this one way that didn't work. And so now you've got time. And maybe that's why, aside from the January 6th thing, I wasn't freaking out about a lot of the coronavirus stuff or anything like that, because I would just keep telling myself that if you get sick, you get sick. You know what I mean? Like, if you listen to that last interview that Christy and I did, and you probably heard this, was the overcoming the fear of flying story that I had said, which was basically exposure therapy. Mm-hmm. But I flew into an ice storm and the plane was having turbulence and I was petrified of commercial flying. And I had just sort of said to myself, this plane goes down, you can't stop it. So, like, what are you going to do about it? And in that moment, I overcame a lifelong fear that had been around for 27 years or 25 years of commercial flying. And it was just like that. So it can be very quick.
Absolutely. I love that story, the fear of flying story. And I appreciate your sharing about one afternoon spent reading John Sarno's book versus, it could be years. I mean, we have clients that are decades in to their, I know you know this, to their surgeries and their injections. So yeah, it's not saying, oh my gosh, psychotherapy, that's going to take forever. Let's just give this patient an injection. No, you're signing them up for decades. There's no end to that. And I'm with you 1,000%. We have to view time differently and value the possibility of therapeutic change and have some hope and some confidence that that can happen quickly.
Christy, we are wrapping up. Somebody somewhere in the world is listening to this right now and they're saying, man, I really like everything that Christy says and that she's about. Where can I find more of her? Can you tell them where they can find more of you?
More of me. You can find it. So like I said, I'm starting a group practice with two fantastic clinicians who I've been working alongside on this United Health Group project. They're joining my private. It's no longer going to be a private practice. It will be a group practice with Mary Claire Dastagenis and Rachel Moore. They are fantastic. You can find information about me and about either of them on ChristyWeepy.com. That will eventually transition to a company name yet to be named, but you'll be able to access it from my personal website. So I'll share that at ChristyWeepy.com since that's evergreen, so to speak.
And will you please spell your last name so people don't think it's W-E-E-P-E-E?
Weepy is U-I-P-I. Polynesian. Okay. Thank you for reminding me that most people would not guess that.
Oh, I know. I'd been emailing Alan Gordon. This was before I'd ever even talked to you. I'd been emailing Alan Gordon and talking about a podcast appearance, and he directed me to you. And when he sent me over your name and the link to your bio, and I was thinking, okay, great, I'm going to email this woman, but how the hell do you say her name, right? That's what I kept thinking throughout that.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, right. Weepy.
Yeah, so it's C-H, and I'll link this in the show notes, but it's ChristyUIPI.com to learn more. Christy, thank you so much. Let's get together again. There's, you know, when you told me you're going to be in Seattle in September, and if you will allow, I would love nothing more than to get together and meet one of my TMS friends in person. Low-key famous. It'd be cool to maybe, you know, do some sound bites or whatever for the podcast. But if it's just a beer, a drink, or a glass of wine, or whatever the case is, that's fine too.
I can't wait. Thank you so much, Eddie, as always.
Okay, thanks.